is 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Veronica Rickert. Coming up, what do young people want from downtown areas? As millennials increasingly move to urban areas, we'll hear how Wisconsin cities are trying to make their downtowns more attractive.
First, 2014 has been an interesting year for video gaming on and off the screen. More and more people are turning to gaming as a hobby on traditional consoles or smartphones and tablets. And in part because of that, gaming is attracting a more diverse audience than ever before.
But according to our next guest, the games themselves aren't keeping up with those changes. She says that, by and large, games and video game characters suffer from a lack of diversity, and that is a problem. Now she's speaking out about underrepresentation in games, and it comes at a time where challenges to the gaming status quo are often met with a hostile reaction or even worse.
Joining us now is Tanya DePass. She's a gamer and creator of the I Need Diverse Games hashtag and Tumblr blog. Tanya, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you very much for having me back.
So this all started with a tweet from you, snowballed into a full-blown social media campaign. Why did you think it was important to tackle this issue?
Well, the tweet literally was, I was angry about video games at 6 in the morning, and it gained traction, and I just ran with it. I mean, it must have struck a nerve. I was witty and on point at the right time, and it's just been going on ever since early October.
So we touched on it a bit in the setup there, but why do you think we need more diverse games, more diverse characters in games?
Because representation matters. I mean, there's a lot of empirical data to show that not seeing yourself reflected in your media affects you. And it would be nice to be able to go out and buy a game and see myself reflected in the character, not just, you know, an NPC that gets shot or killed or, you know, is a villain, but a protagonist. It'd be nice to see myself reflected in a game where I can go save the world, go save the universe, and not have the same few games recycled as, oh, but you have this game. You have, you know, Mass Effect 3 or Beyond Good and Evil to choose from. We need to keep up representation and not have it be such a big deal that, you know, it makes the news. I would like it not to have to be a hashtag or something where people have to go, but this doesn't exist. There's not enough of it.
Well, when we turn on the, I guess, the prototypical video game in most genres, who does our protagonist look like? Who do we look like on the screen when we play that game?
Well, with the exception of games where you can create your own character and give them a bit of personality, you get the same kind of cookie-cutter, scruffy, you know, angry dude protagonist. And there's always someone who's died or will die that fuels their kind of revenge plot. It's the same storytelling, and it's getting, you know, it's getting old. I would like to see stories where, you know, it's set on an alien world, and it's not about revenge fantasy. It's not about a power fantasy. It's about a story. And that doesn't mean that there can't be violence or, you know, a need for that, but that shouldn't be the be-all, end-all of the game.
Well, I guess for
you get the same... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I guess from the perspective of a video game designer or company, these kind of games keep selling. They've got an audience that wants to look like that in the game and will keep paying money for it. What is their incentive to change the way they do things?
I mean, the incentive has to come from the consumer. As long as people keep buying the games, some things may not change. But again, there's data to show that saying that, oh, a game with a female lead or a person of color lead just won't sell isn't true. I mean, look at Lara Croft. Look at that franchise. If that was the case, it wouldn't be getting remakes and new games into 2014 and 2015.
So when video games...
You know, people want
to... Sorry, when video games do include diverse characters, are developers getting those characters right? Or are there times when you see that diverse character and maybe wish that person wasn't there because of the way it ends up being treated?
Yes. You know, as much as I give kudos to BioWare... There are times that there are characters where you just go, you really didn't do a lot of research into it. Or, you know, with the latest Dragon Age that came out, Chromesius Eklasi, or Krem, as a lot of fans call him, is great trans representation. But I personally have issues with the character Vivian because, you know, for a unmistakably Black female character, there's a lot of baggage that comes with her that, you know, I think they kind of fell down on.
Well, now, are there examples you'd point to where you'd say, hey, a major game developer, or even maybe an independent one, really got things right? This is one you'd point toward as an example for maybe others to either emulate or be inspired by.
Definitely Minority Media, Popo and Yo, and Spirits of the Spring. They are amazing. You know, they're really good games. They're games that, you know, also invoke a sense of empathy, which is really important, which I don't think a lot of games do. You know, I do have to give kudos to BioWare, even though I just talked about them. You know, Mass Effect 3, where you could have same-sex romances, and they didn't buckle to pressure to take it out of the game or, you know, kind of retract that after the fact. I'm trying to think of other games that do these things very well. You know, Skyrim, other games where you can have same-sex marriage. I'm not really big into Warcraft, but it seems like it does have good representation as well.
Now, this social media movement comes at a time where there's been some, it's been kind of rocky in the gaming world. Challenges to the gaming status quo have been met with anger, harassment, threats, a lot of it related to the Gamergate movement that we've talked about on this show. How has this message been received in this context? What kind of response are you getting?
Luckily, it's been a very positive response. That's mostly in part to having block tools on Twitter, thanks to a friend of mine who called me at work once the tag started trending. I mean, there has been some negative tweets. There have been some kind of trolling in the tag, both on Tumblr and on Twitter. But at the end of the day, I can't give them my energy or my attention because they'll just detract from it. You know, the tag was hours old before people were trying to kind of glom onto it and claim that, oh, we're diverse, we're not your shield, et cetera, when there was no connection to Gamergate at all when I threw the tag out there.
So a lot of attention gets focused on issues of diversity and representation on, you know, consumer media outlets, like, you know, TV, movies, sometimes the comics and graphic novels. Why is it important that we focus on video games in particular, something that maybe people outside the community might not be aware of this issue at all?
Because gaming is another form of media, you know, and to disagree with the late Roger Ebert, I do believe they are an art form, and as an art form that they should be able to stand to critique. Because not everyone, you know, gets their media fix from movies and TV, or they get all of the above. And if I'm going to drop 60, 70 or more on a video game, it would be nice to see that representation. And that being said, it shouldn't be tokenism, which I think a lot of people are confusing the issue for. You know, they'll take it to one extreme of, well, I guess every character has to be a woman or black or disabled or LGBT. It's just representing the diversity that already exists in the world and not making it about tokenism. And for someone who isn't into gaming to see this, you know, maybe it'll spark their interest. Maybe they'll pick up a controller or, you know, grab a bag of dice and get back into D&D if they hadn't touched it since they were a teenager.
Well, if I were to form a stereotype of a person who's a gamer, I might think of somebody like myself, anywhere from the 12 to mid-40s age range, white male. I'm super into games. But how diverse is the gaming audience in reality?
In reality, it's very diverse. I mean, majority of the people I know and met through gaming are women. A lot of them are women of color, LGBT folks. Yes, the straight white gamer dude stereotype is there and it exists. However, it is not the be-all, end-all. That is not all you will see. I mean, if you go to a game store, you're not going to usually see just white dudes, at least the game store I go to. I can't speak for every single game store out there, but I think the reality is not reflected in the media.
Well, Tanya, thank you so much for joining us. Hope we can talk to you about related issues in the future.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back. And please, anytime you'd like me to come on and talk about these issues, I'd be very happy to come back.
That's Tanya DePass. She's creator of the I Need Diverse Games hashtag. young people are rejecting suburban and rural areas, often in favor of more urban ones. In fact, urban living has in many ways come to define what we see as the millennial generation. They're not buying homes or cars. They value things like inclusiveness, diversity, and the arts.
According to a study by the think tank City Observatory, the number of college-educated people aged 25 to 34 living within 3 miles of city centers has surged, up 37% since 2000.
Many Wisconsin communities have struggled to provide young professionals with attractive urban areas. There's long been a sense that youth leave the state for, say, Chicago, the Twin Cities, maybe even the coasts. When we spoke with Wisconsin business owners this past year, they said a lack of appealing urban areas was a barrier to attracting talent.
There are, however, cities around the state that are working to revitalize their downtown areas in the hopes that it will attract young people and economic opportunities. One example is Eau Claire, which began a concerted effort to redevelop its downtown in the early 2000s and has seen some success.
And you can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you want out of your downtown area? Maybe share examples of things that are being done in your community or that you think should be done. And if you're a younger person in the state, maybe home for the holidays, what could your local downtown area provide you that would make you stay? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Right now, we're joined by Mike Schatz. He is the Economic Development Director of the City of Eau Claire. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
I'd like to start with kind of a snapshot history of Eau Claire's downtown area. You know, a lot of downtowns were thriving retail centers, you know, until the 60s and 70s, and then the mall came, and all of a sudden their whole character changed. And for a long time, it seemed as though downtowns were either failing or sort of lost. What was Eau Claire's situation like in the 80s and 90s?
Well, I would say Eau Claire was very typical of what you've just described. Many of our large department stores left downtown to go out to the malls. You saw a lot of people moving further out into the suburbs as the community grew. And I think the downtown had to sort of reinvent themselves. Downtown Eau Claire has always had a strong presence of employment. We have a lot of government offices downtown, financial institutions, and about one quarter of all our employment is downtown. But what we lacked were the retail, the entertainment, and the housing.
And so when did the city of Eau Claire make a decision? Because every city, I think, that I've heard of, you know, whether you're talking about Wausau or La Crosse or Eau Claire, they've all had some of these same discussions about their downtown. And then people discuss things and then they do studies and then nothing happens and then they discuss things and so on. How did Eau Claire handle that? And when did they start thinking seriously about changing what was happening downtown?
Well, the city of Eau Claire did two key things. One, they created a redevelopment authority, which is the group that is in charge of buying up blighted riverfront property and making the property available to developers after cleaning it up. Sometimes there was contamination on the sites. There was land in the floodplain, so we had to bring that out. And dealing with multiple owners and such, our particular areas of downtown happen to be probably one of the low-end areas of Eau Claire. So that was a key decision in creating that redevelopment authority. And then the second thing happened back in 2001, where the city contracted with an organization called Hyatt Palma, which was a downtown consulting firm that the League of Cities used. And they came up with a downtown action plan that created about 99 recommendations, and including the recommendation to create a new downtown organization called Downtown Eau Claire Incorporated. So since 2002, we call it DECI for short, as the acronym, Downtown Eau Claire Inc. has been working on those 99 recommendations.
Wow, 99. So you got your work cut out for you. But it's been going on for, what, 12 years now, right?
That's correct.
And so if you look at Downtown Eau Claire today and compare it to 2002 or 1995, can you tell the difference?
We certainly can, and it's a great feeling when we get feedback from people who haven't been around for 10 years or so, and they come back and they see the changes that have been made. But like I was saying before, one of the areas in our downtown, which we call the Phoenix Park area, North Barstow Redevelopment District, was the low end of Eau Claire. There was a lot of housing that was not very good, businesses that were contaminated, a field that sat next to our riverfront full of weeds. And now if you go there, it's probably the upper end of Eau Claire with the best views in town, because in Eau Claire, our downtown is on the confluence of two rivers, the Eau Claire and Chippewa River. We have loft housing now and mixed-use buildings. Corporations like Royal Credit Union have built their headquarters there. A young company called Jamp Software has now built a large office on the riverfront. And the Phoenix Park, which we built first to attract redevelopment, has won four different awards for the quality of the park that it is. So you can really see a major difference. And one of the beauties of the whole redevelopment has been how the people of Eau Claire have embraced it and have learned to program some of the public infrastructure that the city has done.
And, you know, part of the whole impetus here was to try to get people to live downtown, to bring young people back and turn this downtown area not just in a place for business, but in a place for homes. And in a place like Milwaukee or Madison, you've seen a lot of that. But in some place the size of Eau Claire, have you seen progress with that too?
Yeah, we've had probably the one thing that other communities say that they like about our downtown revitalization is the success we've had in the housing end of things. We've created over 215 new loft apartments, bringing 300 more people living downtown. And as you mentioned earlier, one of the benefits of downtown, or that you want from a downtown when you invest in your infrastructure of streets and roads and such, is to have it working for you 24/7, so you get a better return on your investment. And housing helps you do that. So as I mentioned before, we had a lot of people living downtown, but they were leaving at 5 o'clock. Now with the housing, they're here 24/7. We've invested in our recreation and our eateries downtown. So it's a really happening place, a place where people want to go and gather, and it really has turned things around for us.
So let me ask this, though. Where did the money come from? Because, you know, part of it, I imagine the city had to get involved at some point, perhaps the county. But how do you prime the pump, so to speak, so that private developers want to show up and then add to that mix?
Well, in several instances, the city committed economic development funds to the Redevelopment Authority for purchasing up blighted properties. In many instances, we use tax incremental financing to help, which is a mechanism that many cities use for their urban redevelopment. And then the key was to invest in public infrastructure like Phoenix Park, our bike trails, gathering spaces, green space along the river, public transportation, farmers market downtown, bike-friendly and pedestrian-friendly streets and sidewalks. And once we had that, the private sector stepped up and started investing. So we've really had developers doing the housing and the mixed-use buildings that have commercial on the bottom floor and housing on the upper floors. We're seeing a real neat event here in that a lot of the younger 30-somethings are investing in the downtown too. And that really is makes us feel good that the people that are really pushing for these trends and this to happen are also investing their money. So it's definitely public-private partnerships that are continuing what the city started. We've got a very large project in Eau Claire's downtown that we call the Confluence Project, and that's a public partnership between the city, the county, the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, and developers, in which we have two buildings, one that is already broken ground. It's a multi-use, mixed-use building where there will be commercial on the bottom, 25,000 square feet, in which we hope there will be several restaurants on the riverfront. But also it will have housing for 300 students or others and a parking ramp in it. And then the second component that we're working on is a performing arts center that the university would share with other arts and culture groups downtown to have a space that they all could use and have additional office space and share a lot of the things that you need for the arts so that everybody benefits and the costs are kept to a minimum. And in between that, we hope to have some a very nice public space that would tie it all together and want to bring people down to hang out in between the two buildings.
All right. The Confluence, the Performing Arts Center, public space, a lot to talk about there, and we're going to pick that up in just a few minutes. We're talking with Mike Schatz. He is the Economic Development Director of the City of Eau Claire, and we're talking about what young people in particular want from their downtown areas and what some Wisconsin communities are doing to try to keep those young people from moving away.
And this is an issue facing communities around the state, and we'd love to hear the story of your community. Call in now at 800-642-1234. What do you want out of your downtown area? This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickert. We are back talking with Mike Schatz, Economic Development Director of the City of Eau Claire, and we're talking about what young people want from their downtown areas and what Wisconsin cities are doing to reach out to them.
And you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. What's happening in your community? What is being done to revitalize the downtown? Our young people are staying or going. If you're a younger person yourself, maybe just out of high school or college, what would keep you where you live? What would chase you away? 800-642-1234 is the number to call or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we've got some calls we'll be getting to in just a second. Before we do that, though, Mike Schatz, one of the things that occurs to me as you're talking about the work that's been done in Eau Claire is that there is a need for patience here. You said that, you know, a lot of the heavy lifting has been done since 2002. In the middle, of course, there have been changes in administration, I imagine, in city government in Eau Claire and the city council and so forth. There's been the Great Recession. There have been a lot of challenges. How do you keep your eyes on where you want to go in the midst of all these things that are changing all the time around you?
Well, that is a difficult thing to do, but you have to have a vision, and I think that's what we put together, and you try to follow that through. We went through, like you say, the recession. We also redid our whole our major downtown street, which is South Barstow. And so our businesses had to live through the recession plus the reconstruction of the street. And so that, you know, that was difficult for a lot of the small mom-and-pop retail shops. But I think they could see where we were going with this, the steps that we were taking, the collaboration with the private sector. And I think we built around this Phoenix Park and some of the events and programming of it. We have a company in town called Volume One, and they've done a fabulous job of making sure people knew about all the arts, the culture, the music that was going on. So now people always know when there are what's to do on a weekend and through the week. They've been strong proponents of the revitalization of downtown. And I think just showing the people the vision and that we were making progress, I think, has been good. And, you know, give credit to our city councils and our boards. They've been patient and they've been supportive with their financial resources and their volunteering to make it happen.
Let's go to the phones right now and find out what listeners have to say. And we begin with Adam, who joins us from Oconomowoc. Hi.
Hey, how's it going? I was just calling, like I said, I'm from Oconomowoc. Moved there about 7 months ago, young family. We have a child. And what's really nice, what was really appealing to us about Oconomowoc is they're updating it and they're bringing it, you know, into our age group. But yet they're still keeping that small town feel. So you can still go downtown, walk around with the family. It's still a small town, little shops. Everyone's real friendly. Everyone really knows who you are. But it's still got that more updated look to it and that updated feel. So it's nice to see them, you know, putting the money into the city to bring in the younger people and keeping the town bustling. So,
Adam, thanks for the call. And Mike Schatz, Economowoc, sort of a different situation than Eau Claire, and a reminder that when you're looking at it, it sounds as though there's not just a one-size-all-fits approach here.
No, there's definitely not. And you have to keep in mind that in a city, you're dealing with people from all different age groups, religions, a very diverse group. And so you try to make something happen that fits all the different areas, or at least some components of it. So, you know, Eau Claire is received national recognition for a great place to raise a family, a great place to retire. So you also want to, you know, do things that make it easy for people on limited incomes when they retire, but also, as the caller was saying, keeping those family values. And I think that's one of the strengths of Eau Claire. A lot of our events that Downtown Eau Claire Inc. puts on, and Visitor Eau Claire and Volume 1, are all family-oriented. And it's really neat to see all the kids come down. We recently did a lighting of Phoenix Park where we raised funds to put Christmas lights all on the trees throughout the park. And we had the Children's Theater provide us with people that could play the parts of the actress in Frozen. And so all the kids came down because of Frozen, and they frolicked in the snow in the park while the Christmas trees were being lighted. And that's the type of events we're looking at to gear towards the families and keeping our values.
Let's go to Appleton right now, and we are joined by Kari. Hi, Kari.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. So College Avenue changed for you after you left and came back?
Yeah, absolutely. So I went to college away, and then I took a year and lived abroad. And so I was gone for a good 5 years. And then when I came back, I just feel like they've done a really good job of attracting younger people and more unique businesses than I had really experienced before. And then they also have more young events. And I was talking before to whoever answered the phone about Mile of Music. I don't know if you've
sure.
Part of it, but it's this, yeah, it's just like kind of music festival that's all original musicians. And a lot of my friends growing up, they came back for that event. And it was just really, it felt like something that was, that should have been in a bigger city, but without all the inconveniences. So, yeah, I think Appleton's doing a good job. There's definitely room to go, but it's doing well for me now.
So let me ask you this, Kari, is it going to be enough to keep you hanging around Appleton? Say, I mean, or are you going to start looking around for something else?
I think, and it's funny because I think they're doing good for what they are working with, but I'm definitely looking to move to a city. So I guess, I don't know, it's kind of hard because you want a bit of a balance. But there are, I think I'm more unique in that there are a lot of people who do want to come back and live there and start a family or do whatever they want to do, start their career. And another thing actually that I found too is it's so much easier to get higher jobs, better titles, better positions as a younger person. There's not competition, so that's been nice as well. Yeah.
Well, Kari, thanks so much for the call. And Mike Stotz, you heard the challenge right there. Appleton, in her estimation, has done a lot of really good things. It's a place she likes to be, but she's still thinking about moving to a bigger city.
Yeah, we deal with that all the time. There are people that do want to, you know, get out of their hometown or where they went to college and go experience other places. But a lot of times we do get them back, you know, when they go to start a family and such. But in a town of like Eau Claire, where you have roughly a little over 10,000 students, you know, if you can get them right out of college too and keep them here, involve them in the community so that they want to stay, that's another part of what we're trying to do. And leading to that would be making sure that there are quality job opportunities. So what we're seeing here is that we've had some businesses that were homegrown from Eau Claire that have grown to, you know, 150, 200 jobs in Eau Claire that can hire software majors right out of the university. They have about 10 to 20 interns every year there. So if you can grow something like that where you have a pipeline from the university with the talent and the skills to go right into a business that has opportunities, I think that's a big benefit. And then the other thing that goes along with that is the surge in the millennials being willing to take risks and start entrepreneurial jobs and such. We're seeing a lot of young people that just want to go out there and give it a shot to be their own boss and to create some opportunities. And we've tried to build a relationship with the entrepreneur program at UW-Eau Claire. Some of our businesses have created co-working spaces. The city has invested in the infrastructure, technology, the internet and Wi-Fi and all the things that people would need to do business, you know, anywhere in the world. And I think that's a big part, too, of keeping the millennials.
Let's go to Claire now. Claire joins us from Reedstown. Hi.
Hi. I have terrible reception right now, so if I cut out, I apologize.
Okay.
I grew up in La Crosse, and I went to college in Madison and Milwaukee. But I decided to move to the Twin Cities because the opportunities weren't there for me in La Crosse. And what I've seen in some communities is that they'll do these Band-Aid solutions where they might throw in an Applebee's or something that doesn't fit in with the character of the downtown. And the development isn't very thoughtful. And it seems like Eau Claire is doing thoughtful development.
Well, Claire, thanks a lot for that call. And Mike Schatz, we've got just a few seconds here for you to kind of wrap up, but it sounds like she was heading towards that vision thing that you talked about so much.
Yeah, I think that's very important. You want to make sure that whatever your redevelopment is, it is a fit for your community, blending new with the old. I like to use this example. I'm dealing with a lot of breweries and distilleries that are starting up in Eau Claire, and there's three requirements that they want. They want an older building with character, they want to be on the riverfront, and they want to be on the bike trail. So we try to make that happen, but we also make sure that we are looking new and vibrant too. So some of the buildings have the newer look that millennials want. Our Royal Credit Union that built the
And we've got to let you go, Mike, but thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Mike Schatz, Economic Development Director of the City of Eau Claire, about the city's efforts to attract young people to their downtown.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. Crystal Chan grew up a multiracial kid in Wisconsin. She's been finding her place and answering people's questions about her race ever since.
Growing up in Oshkosh was ideal in many ways. There were quiet streets, woods to explore, clear, starry night skies. The only thing missing were other mixed-race kids like me. I'd get the question a lot, what are you? I'd give my routine answer. My dad is Chinese and my mom is white, so I am half and half. Sometimes people would cock their heads, confused. Sometimes they would ask how my parents could ever have possibly met. Sometimes their eyebrows would raise and they would say, gosh, you're so exotic. In the beginning, I liked their questions and their various reactions. I'd make people guess what I was, and I'd get everything from Russian to Filipino to Greek to Spanish. No one would ever guess correctly. And as I got older, when I'd tell people the truth, sometimes they would retort that I'm wrong, I'm not half Chinese. On more than one occasion, someone demanded that I show my driver's license as proof. Proof of my own existence, I guess. Later on in college, the question, what are you, started to bother me. First of all, why am I a what when everyone else is a who? And more importantly, I wasn't sure why the question mattered so very much in the first place. Once, someone stared at me from the other side of the street, crossed over, and demanded to know what I was. Like most cases, she didn't want to get to know me. When I told her what my mix was, she muttered, "I knew you didn't fit," and promptly walked away. It's said that the United States is a melting pot, but I'm not sure that we, as a country, across the generations, are comfortable with the realities of that melting. Maybe we prefer more the tossed salad approach, different items thrown in together but still separate. If the melting pot image is at all true, then this country has an insatiable hunger to know what exactly is being melted together. I get the exotic line frequently, meant always as a compliment. "Oh, I'm so plain, but you are so exotic," people would say. But when I look in the mirror, I wouldn't see anyone exotic. I just see plain old me. Exotic means something doesn't grow naturally in its habitat, that it's from another part of the world, that it doesn't quite belong. Wisconsin was where I was born and raised. I know the country roads. How could I possibly be out of place? How could I possibly be exotic? It took me a long time to realize that the word exotic reflects only the speaker's perspective, not at all what or who the person is speaking about. For example, an orchid is exotic in Wisconsin. Snow is exotic in Singapore. I'm waiting for the day when the word exotic won't pop up anymore when I give my racial background, because we'll be used to races mixing, no matter where we live. In the meantime, I look forward to conversations where race is not a point of alienation or objectification, but a starting point for dialogue, where we can celebrate our uniqueness as well as our points of deepest connection. When people now tell me I'm exotic, I smile and thank them for the compliment, knowing also that the humid smell of cornfields runs deep in my blood.
Crystal Chan is a writer, professional storyteller, and the author of the young adult novel, Bird.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a collaboration between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org and check out the Wisconsin Life Facebook page.
For more on the topic of multiracial identity and questions like, what are you? Jennifer Patrice Sims joins us. She's researching these questions as a doctoral candidate in sociology at UW-Madison. Jen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, is this question just a daily part of life for people with multiple racial backgrounds?
For some people, yes, it is. I would, when asking interviewees about the question, I would get responses from, I was asked earlier today, I was asked last week, I was asked last month. So people, yes, they receive this question very, very often.
And is it universally an annoying question?
It is not universally annoying. For about half of my respondents, they found the question very annoying, very tiresome. Like Crystal Chan said, at first, when you're younger, you answer. But as you get into your 20s, into your 30s, into your 40s, this does become very wearisome. So for about half of my interviewees, they found the question annoying and cumbersome.
Well, I don't know if everyone knows the motivations behind asking it. As Crystal said there, at least one woman explicitly said, I knew you didn't fit. But is it sometimes maybe not malicious, maybe just curiosity expressed awkwardly?
Yes. So there's usually two reasons that the interviewees that I interviewed felt that they were being asked. One was based on their appearance. Their appearance, as Crystal said in her piece, was a bit, quote, exotic for the location that they were in. Men said that usually their light skin coupled with, say, African features or Asian features would make someone kind of wonder if they were mixed race and so ask. Women often said that the texture of their hair coupled with either their skin color or their eye shape, for example, would make people want to ask. So some would see those as, okay, someone's just being curious. You're just paying attention. If it was, people would ask parents about children. Some parents would say, well, you're just appreciating that the way my child looks like this. And so then they wouldn't see it as very annoying. Other times, though, with regards to behavior, someone would get asked. So if you have, say, a black-white person that appears maybe a little bit more black, but they're, quote, well-spoken or they're, quote, educated, then somebody may, drawing on negative stereotypes of blacks, want to know, oh, well, are you part white? As kind of maybe that's an explanation for why you don't, as one of my interviewees said, someone told him, you don't act anything like the blacks on Cops. Well, they're drawing on stereotypes and trying to ask, well, what are you? Because the person doesn't fit into their kind of explanation, their small, narrow view of what different types of racial minorities ought to be.
And I don't know if you encountered this in interviewing people, but it did it vary by place? I could see someone maybe who stood out in a maybe mostly white community getting the question a lot. Somebody maybe in an urban environment with lots of international people in and out, it might not be noticed at all.
Exactly, yes. So my dissertation is comparative. I'm looking at the United States and the United Kingdom. Mm. And many interviewees mentioned that getting asked the question a lot less in London. It's such a metropolitan city. It's so cosmopolitan that they just sort of blend in. Everyone's from somewhere else. Everyone is, there's a large mixed race population. Versus when they were growing up, say, in the south of England, or say, growing up in Yorkshire in the north of England, or here in America, folks growing up in rural Wisconsin, then they move to, say, New York, or they move to Los Angeles. And it's a bigger city, then they do notice that the questions come less when they are in bigger multicultural cosmopolitan places.
I've seen some controversy online over the other question, where are you from? Is that one you looked into?
I did. That question is more often asked in the United Kingdom, given the difference in our histories of immigration. Mm-hmm. The United States has had non-white citizens here ever since the founding versus the United Kingdom. It's been a much smaller population. It's only been since World War II and the fall of the different colonies that non-whites have immigrated and mixed in the United Kingdom. So there, where are you from, is the what are you, basically, question that we get more here in the United States.
I've seen it here more in the context of Asian Americans, people, where are you from? Northern California. No, where are you from? Well, L.A. before that. And eventually, if you trace back five generations, you get to another country in that conversation.
Yes, that is a particular, there's a research in sociology on how Asians are seen as forever foreigners. Where are you from? California. Where are your parents from? California. Where are your grandparents from? As one of my interviews said, why does it matter where my ancestors are from 500 years ago?
Well, take this all together, the who are you, where are you from, and this notion of being exotic. When you're talking to people here in the U.S., in the U.K., is there a sense of like, I don't know, I'm not accepted here?
There is, exactly as Crystal said. If you're seen as exotic, that means you're not accepted in this place. And that's why this question, where are you from, what are you white, can become so wearisome over the course of days, months, years when you're asked, because you're constantly not seen as from the place that you feel like you are from.
Is there a more positive way to have this conversation, either something you've observed or a way that you've heard from the people you've talked to?
Yes, actually, if you're in the context of getting to know someone, if you're meeting a new friend, you're making a new friend, you're establishing connection, then most of my interviewees did not mind being asked where they're from. They didn't mind being asked, what race are you? It was in the context, as Crystal said in her piece, someone coming up to her across the street, people coming up to you in grocery stores when you're shopping, just in different places. They're not trying to get to know you. They've just seen you, racially objectified you, and now they want to ask you this, you know, somewhat personal question to some people. But in the context of we're meeting new friends, we're making connections, we're establishing relationships, then it can be seen as a very positive. It's discussing the way we are mixed. It's discussing our backgrounds. And so then it's fine.
So more getting to know than, I guess, fitting into a category.
Exactly. If you're trying to just pigeonhole someone and you're just looking at them and because of your range of understanding of phenotypes, you can't place them, if that's your only rationale for asking someone, well, then the person's probably going to see that as a bit disrespectful. But if you're making a new friend, if you're establishing a new connection and you're just generally trying to get to know someone, then, you know, you can ask back and forth. You can ask where they're from. They can ask where you're from and you can establish that bond and that rapport.
We'll leave it there. Jen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Jennifer Patrice Sims. She's a doctoral student in sociology at UW-Madison.